and a lot of people, you know. Since they want to be what, you know, because the people were young. And that's what was happening. If the ladies was hanging around and they want to be a part of it, you know. So what they and the crumbs that fell from that situation. Now some went on and stayed in art off and on, you know. Like Mervyn did to a degree, and still does.
What was the the local art community like? Not.
It wasn't for black people.
There was no.
Wasn't for black people when I was a kid. Except that I remembered seeing as a barber shop on Preston, and this man was a barber, and when he didn't have customers, he worked on his paintings. Because I didn't know. I was fascinated by watching him. And so that was my, other than my brothers and sisters used to draw. But this is a older man that I saw practicing, you know, and I didn't know it. I didn't know enough then to ask him who he was because I wasn't a scholar. I guess I was a budding scholar because I used to hang out at the library and read a lot. I didn't hang out with the other guys and doing the kind of things they did. I wasn't extremely athletic, although I played, you know, we played standby hoops in the street when I was young with basketball, and we played football and, you know, like kids do in the street or vacant lots. So we call Sandlot. But other than that, and the other thing, I just art. And I decided in high school that I was going to pursue it in a serious manner, in the fact that I just wanted to know more about it. And and then I went into self-study. Because I was, I naively believed that I could be an artist. My mother and father didn't know enough. They thought, like most people at the time, well, he'll do something serious. Because that's the way, and especially for a young black youth. But as I read more and more, I naively. And living in a black community, you know, you had to fight with white boys because they was white because you were black. But I believe that once I took my art to white establishments, I thought they would hire me. And then none of them, I call Louisville a home of polite racism. None of them openly just said, look, we don't not gonna hire no black person, no Negro, none of this. They would come up with excuses. Well, you can't do this. And I would say, what? Because I looked in the paper and I saw fashion drawings and stuff like that. And I said, well, I'll go to the Selma, the stewards at Selma, some other places. They had fashion artists, so, you know, I thought that could be an apprentice or something. And they would say, well, you can't, we would hire you, but you can't do this. So I learned, and then I decided, well, maybe I gotta get some training. So I took, I saw this thing in correspondence, but draw me and you can, you know. So I took that and found out that I didn't get a scholarship. They wanted to charge me $10 a month. And I did that for a while, and so I took those correspondence courses. And I still, but you know, and I learned to do everything they told me to do in there. And I thought naively that, you know, so I'd go to, then I learned about advertising. There's one or two in the city, Anderson and something else, and I'd go down there, and they were, you know, surprised to see. I didn't know how the white seat, that kind of thing. So they would let me in. They were polite, and then criticize you, but you can't do this. I said, well, let me see it. So I learned to do that, and I'd come back 4 or 5 months later, and you, well, you can't do this. And I went to different places. Mm-hmm. I remember once being hired. I went to a print shop, a printing place, and the owner, or the boss, looked at myself. He said, oh, that's great. He said, my artist just left us. I need an artist. So he said, can you do such and such a thing? And I started doing. I worked there in the artist room and did what he wanted me to do. And he said, you know, you got the job. And I worked that evening because it was something he needed translated from pictures of motors that he was doing a catalog. You know, I realized he was doing a catalog for somebody. So I did line drawings of him in pen and ink. And he said, yeah, you got the job. I went back the next day, and he was really embarrassed because the whites in the shop said, well, we're not going to work in a place where you have no niggas, no artists. He said, I can't hire you because the other workers refused to work where a black man would sit in an office and they work in the shop. I didn't see that fully at the time. And of course, that's why I became a professor, because I wanted to know and understand. Mm-hmm. But I had any number of those kinds of experience. And so the guy let me work at home until he could find somebody, and he paid me freelance. But my dream at the time was to be a magazine illustrator with Saturday Evening Post and Collier's, because they had people that did. So I was destined. I studied on my own. And then one of the places I can't remember in town said, well, have you been to art school? I said, well, I take art response course. He said, but you need to maybe do the degree. So I started taking courses, and I enrolled at the University of Louisville. And because by that time I had self-trained and self-taught correspondence courses, and I got a half scholarship here at U of L. And I got a degree. And I kept trying to get a job. I remember I was at one of the agencies at one time, and the guy said, I just got a call from the art director at the Courier Journal, and he needs an artist pad. So I go over there, I talk to the guy on the phone, because he got him on the phone. He said, yeah, send him over. So I got to the Courier Journal. It was a 6th Street opening up on the front door. And he's, I was actually on the 4th floor. So I go to get on the elevator, and somebody stopped me. He said, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going to see Mr. White, or whoever his name was. He wants me to come up. He said, what are you going, why are you going up there? I said, well, he wants me, you know, I had my portfolio. Oh, you can't go up there now. You got to go and come in here. So they took me into the hiring office. I said, I must have called him and said, hey, my bedroom, said, hey, you got a nigga down here. You know, I don't think you want that. And so they took my name and everything, and I never did see him. I said, but he wanted me because he wanted to take the job. He told me on the phone. And then it began to dawn on me. But oddly enough, in between that, and I guess I had finished my degree in art history, art, sculpture and painting. Of course, I also began to understand other things too. I got my first, met two young students that had been in Howard, some places. And I became aware of African history. And history, because we've been taking it in to teach her, and she's no black history, nothing like that out here. But I began to study on my own, read Du Bois and other people. And then I became aware of institutional of kind of racism. But I finished my degree and in 68, they had the riots. In the meantime, I had been talking to them, the director, the CEO at Urban League, about, you know, what are you doing now about, you know, you're doing things that help with employment.
Mm-hmm.
How can I be employed as an artist? So I did that. I kept bugging him about that. And after the riot, he said, well, go over here to the Curry. And when by that time, I'd had an art degree. I was beginning to civil rights. Because in 59, Martin Luther King came to town. And I went to hear me and four or five other people. Because I'd read his book, Walk Toward Freedom, Stride Toward Freedom. And now I was aware of the larger civil rights and other things that he was dealing with. But my reading had expanded. Now I was reading, you know. I began to study the earlier pioneers of the civil rights struggle in America, equal rights and stuff. When I got to the Curry and they hired me, I was pissed. Nobody in there had an art degree. All them white boys had been hired as an apprentice. And now none of them was my artistic equal or my intellectual equal. They hadn't been because they were ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what racism does to white folk. It makes them think because of some superficial skin coloring that they own the world. And what they do is cool, what they, you know. I was there for 8 years. I got along with some of them, but anytime anything was said, I took them to task. They just did not have the intellectual background that I had. We got along very well, but I'm sure they I was a thorn in their side. Because I was arrogant, self-assured, could do anything they could do artistically. None of them had the full range of art background in a practice at heart that I had. Because I had been forced to learn all these different things. Because I began to realize then that what racism does, it destroys the spirit. And why I didn't become an addict or a drunk or something else is just amazing. It either crushes you or makes you stronger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I worked there for 8 years. Because I got another job at the Army Map Service. Because I went out there to get a job through the government. And they didn't hire me. They hired somebody who I'd been in school with. A guy had took classes at UL with. And he was not, I don't know if he finished his degree or not. But, because at that time, the EEO had started the equal the government. So I said I was gonna. So I wrote a letter to the wherever and complained that I'd been a victim of racism because I applied. They finally found me a job. Wasn't the one I applied for, but so I worked at the training aides at out at Fort Knox for 2 years, and then I got the job in town with a courier. American and of course by that time, in the meantime, we had started the Sam Gilliam and then Bob Thompson, some other people. We were students at UOL. And because we couldn't show our works at the galleries, one or two in town, we started Gallery Enterprises. And that's what I wrote about that. Mm-hmm. And after that, Sam left and went to D.C. Because I had five children, so I couldn't go. One of the professors, visiting a professor from Germany, Crodell, really liked my work, and he wanted me to come with him to be an apprentice, under him. And he was going to New York, but I couldn't go because I had responsibilities. He wanted me to finish my graduate degree. And I'd be his an assistant, because he talked about my work at that time as a expressionist, because I was doing expressionism, but from a black perspective, because I refused. At that time, all the young people said in art wanted to be abstract expressionists. They wanted to be a Pollock or a Klein, and I just refused, because by then I'd become aware of art history. And because I was first told out here that black people had no history, they hadn't done anything of importance in the world, they had contributed nothing to civilization, because I'd begin to study and realize that was false. And so for that reason, I knew if I didn't champion black people's movements or whatever, that no one would. So I refused to go non-figurative. So most of my paintings and sculptures and stuff have been figurative. Abstract, somewhat abstract, but Crodell was amazed at my use of color and stuff. Another colleague, a teacher here, when he visited him in Munich, and I was at a party once, and the guy said, you wouldn't believe what I saw, because this professor, he and I didn't get along, because I didn't realize that I married my present wife, and she said, you know, people know immediately how you dismiss them. So he taught design, and if something was said wrong, I take him to task as a student. But we got along. But he was saying he told Kennedy and said that he saw that Crodell had one of my paintings. Because Crodell had been a German expressionist, and because he knew Picasso and all the other guys. Because as a young man, he had been to Paris, and he was an art professor at Munich University, and he was just here visiting. And he came to U of L, and then he went to NYU. If I had been single and no children, I'd have been caught up in probably a European scene, but it wasn't. Anyway, he said, your painting is on the wall with Picasso and so are my others. I said, what painting? He explained. I said, that's what happened to the painting. I kept wondering what happened to that painting. He had taken it. he had taken it and framed it, and he would say that was one of his students' work. When I went to Munich, I didn't have his, I should have called him. Because I went during the Christmas holidays, but he was away up in Bavaria. I was on my way I wanted to go to Europe, and I was on my way to Africa because I was teaching then part-time here. And I was teaching, I had created African art, African-American art class. And the people who had taught me here said, there's no such thing, but I created it, I began to study. So I'd been a part of the struggle to create Pan-African studies. But I didn't have a master's or a PhD at the time. And so the chair, Tom Green, had me to fill out the program. The department offerings. I taught African American art for him. And he had to teach African art as well. And I have, of course, because of what I had studied, when I would, like, students would ask, well, how do you know that? Because I was teaching them things about Africa that nobody had ever told them. Well, were you there? And so I said, I need to go, I need to know, I need to fill this picture out. And at that time I was working at the Courier and I was teaching here part-time. But we had already created Gallery Enterprises, and that held on for about 3 years. What we did down there, very interesting. As a student, we created what people call the St. James Art Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had a clothesline show in Peterson's yard. He lived on St. James Court. And it grew. And now I don't know this side of it, if anybody has written their history. But I know that up until that time, it was black and white students. At the time, we had clothesline shows in October. And we did that to help pay our bills, because we all had old Peterson was a proprietor. His wife taught at the Art Association, and U of L had at that time, didn't have an art department, they were building one. But most of the students in art took classes at, because they taught drawing and painting and other things as well. Miss Peterson taught art, jewelry making. And Lou Block taught painting for the university in one class, one course. But most of our classes was taken in drawing and in painting at the Art Association, that building that's across campus wasn't that big, but it was up on First Street. And right in front of Bingham Hall, Bingham Humanities, little building was an art association. The building's still there. So we taught most of our course. The campus ended at that time, the campus ended at Gottschalk and Gardner. That was the beginning of the campus. So we walked down the street, First Street, over to the art association. And let's see what else. I was teaching out here part time. Some other things happened. The gallery, and not only that, at the St. James Art Fair began to grow. But the last big event we had, I think I wrote about that, was the creation of the a Central Park happening. And after that, Sam left, and so the main, but nobody left but two of us, Fred Bond and myself. So from 63, we sit and work together for G.C. Cox. And in 67, I think it was when we created the local art workshop. And but at the time, of course, both times was an integrated group. Although we begin to read about the Black Arts Movement, how artists, some artists in other parts of the country, in California, New York, Chicago, had was doing their search for was tying their art to the struggle. Black Arts Movement is a part of the Black Liberation Struggle, where the artists, they call themselves revolutionary artists, and their work, I wanted their work to reflect and be of some cultural significance to the second phase of the civil rights struggle. And they've moved away from civil rights to more direct action. And of course, how they got decimated by the CIA and the government. Nobody can prove that, but it's very obvious what happened, that outside forces, they were afraid of, Hoover didn't hide his fear of Black people, because he thought that when it became the Black Liberation Struggle, an artist joined the group. He said that the Black Panthers and others were the most dangerous. Okay. So it's an open warfare, and we now know about the propaganda pro COINTEL. You know, that's been, and you can research that. But the Black closest thing we came to that in Louisville was while the other artists, well, Sam went off and became one of the Abstract Expressionist School, several phases of that, and Ken also. Bob Carter remained pretty much a figurative artist, but and a professor at U of L on Long Island. But here in Louisville, my work was the one that's I wanted my work to celebrate the achievements and the life of Black people. So I was the artist inside that group. That because I didn't want my work to be after I was dead and gone. I wanted people to be sure that the Black artist did that. Mm-hmm. Must have did that. And I guess naively or whatever, arrogantly, I refused to sign my works, because I realized that if you put together a large enough body of work, that it speaks for itself. It tells you can even the changes that Picasso made in his art, you can tell the Picasso from others, because the signature is there. You can't be who you are and remain true to who you are without telling people who you are if they are thorough in their analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You were talking about the kind of how the broader black arts movement was moving. Did you all associate with that at all in Louisville, Louisville Art Workshop?
No. Yeah. Because we had an integrated group, and I think that ameliorated. Although, toward the end, in 70, after I had left the workshop, they realized that the speed wasn't showing black work, and they had some problem with an open show that on 4th Street. They were trying to do something that they didn't show their work either. So they had began to become they had some protests. Somebody in the group, and I said, man, I told y'all that a long time ago.
You know? About that heavy sandwich there, Dr. Douglas. I think I saw the bag.
Oh, yeah.
I'll just grab it and get out of your way.
I said, well, it's up here. I was a hit face.
You were?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Everybody else was
all right. I hope some pictures were taken.
I got
Laura's
got one.
Okay.
I'm sure. Yeah, they got some.
Okay. I'm glad you have fun.
Yeah, they had fun.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I've been proud. But I had moved away from the civil rights to my own thinking and more like Malcolm X. And so I said I wasn't going to get involved. So they were in a protest mood then. I said, you know, it's gone to another phase. Yeah, gone to another phase. Because I had been a community organizer under the beginning of the war on poverty for 2 years. And I was a community organizer. And I left that to take the job at Curry at the Fort Knox because I had taken I knew the next step was needed if you couldn't lead people to an armed struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anything about an armed struggle. I thought I'd had a chance to go back into art, so I did. I got out of the although, you know, I consider myself a cultural nationalist.
Your involvement as an urban renewal relocation officer, did that inform your art at all?
No, that informed me to how people were being manipulated. I saw that as the next step for that urban renewal, and only one area was mostly attacked. That was the black business area.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized they didn't have enough to, most of them didn't own the property itself. Some of them did. Most of them just operated the businesses. And there were usually some non-black behind them. But they didn't know enough to, and I didn't know enough to get out of the urban renewal and try to organize them. I did get out of urban renewal, but I became a community organizer in the war on poverty. But at the time I was at urban renewal, I didn't know enough to say, man, what y'all ought to be doing? They should have demanded to be located collectively together, because they didn't understand how economic and capitalism, how businesses feed off each other. And that's why they were successful. Because you could eat, haircut, cleaners, you know, the whole thing from 6th Street to 13th Street. And that's why their businesses were successful. They were all good at what they did, but that area was successful like it was all over the South. And the worst thing happened to them, best thing happened to the country maybe, but the worst thing happened to the black businesses is the integration.
Mm-hmm.
Because they thought that wherever they went, since they knew what they knew, they was gonna make it. But it capitalism is a much more pernicious beast than that. It's something else. And most young blacks still don't understand it.
Was your art, or anybody else's for that matter, but predominantly yours, was it politically motivated at all?
No, because they wanted to be part of the mainstream. And my last book details that. I just began to understand it. I did it out of a refusal not to be me. And I wasn't going to let, I wanted to be successful, turn me against myself and my people, because I understand myself and my people. I never bought into the individualistic argument. Man wouldn't be here if he'd just been an individual.
Mm-hmm.
If he didn't depend on the group, they never could have taken down a mammoth or fight off a wolf or whatever animals that were bigger than them if they didn't have a collective. And whenever they were caught alone, they died. Those hunters who got caught alone, we don't know nothing about them. We only know about the people that survive, and they survive on the collective effort. And but America's been very successful at tricking people into that individualism shit. The idea of the right to work law. That's a right to rape you law.
Mm-hmm.
But they forget that the most perfect form of capitalism is slavery. With slavery, you make the most and you give up the least of what you get for it. Total. And the closer corporations can get their workers to give up their individual rights, because when you become individuals, you've given up individual rights. And they don't understand that. This seems to be contradictory. And the closer they can get them to allow themselves to be exploited, the more money corporations make.
Mm-hmm.
And because they give a share back, capitalism will always keep more than it gives away. You can't be a capitalist, you can't be rich if you do that. And anytime you have more than what you need, somebody somewhere has got less than they need. And so, but some businesses are doing a better job at dealing with public welfare than others. They're the less vicious ones. But the latest example is this guy that bought this company and the medicine for the AIDS victims is $13.95. And he changed it to $1,395 a pill. See, I got the right to do that. I own this. Now, the people that created it was making money at $13.95 a pill. He had the audacity to charge them $1,395 a pill. And then, after people raised hell with him, he entertained down to $900 a pill. So that's what the laws of this country has allowed capitalists to do, give them that kind of power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, you have a right to be rich. Everybody's got a right to be rich. It's not, you don't have to be born to be rich. You don't have to be an aristocrat. You don't have to be an aristocracy. But you move from a familiar aristocracy to a monetary aristocracy. And which goes back into a familiar, because I want to make enough for my children.
Mm-hmm.
So So they do, they're slowly moving back into an old style aristocracy. And unless your group, your people your age do something about that, your grandchildren won't have a standard chance.
Well, I actually, mm-hmm. I thought it was a good change because, and the reason why I asked you,
they'll slowly become slaves without knowing they're slaves.
Even in like non-academic sense, I've got a lot of questions about my main.
In your essay, you spoke that Sam Gilliam saw the potential to challenge racial discrimination through the arts. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I don't know how politically conscious he was about that, but it's evident that when he realized, and I don't know how much he realized that he went to D.C., he became a part of the Colorfield School of Abstract Expressionism, of the Hard Edge Expressionism. And he had become aware of it because he'd begin to do some hard-edge expressionism here. So when he went to D.C., he became a part of it. But he was just imitative. It's obviously that they probably treated him as a, I don't know this, but I understand. What I know of the people that have power and influence, that he was just a cast-off Nolan or Newman. You know, if you look at the Nolan works, the hardest expression of Kelly, Ellsworth Kelly. But when he dyed his canvas, first the dyed canvas and then and moved to a color, a more expressive color of his, you know, although his heart is, it was still what I would call a black use of color. It became, the contrast became more brilliant, but especially with his soft dyed things that he moved, and then he draped them. He just blew the world apart. Because they were always looking for something new. And because I never asked him about what Kelly and Newman and others thought of him after when he did that. But the emphasis, the hard edge, from what I could look at it to see, they never became the same after. This young Sam Gilliam had his show. He finally got one, and he changed his thing to something differently. And I think he stopped the hardest expressionism in their tracks. Because he became something new and exciting. And he met with a lot of opposition to the people in D.C. that were part of the Black Arts Movement, because they were tying their art to the struggle of black people. Mm-hmm. And his success with the black man says one thing, says enlarged possibilities. But his criticism he met with it is that it wasn't directly in opposition to institutional racism or anything like that. But the first job as an artist is just remain an artist. And if you don't garner patrons that buy your work, you're not going to make it. So it's based on patronism. The thing that saved a black arts movement artist was that by this time you had an increased number of blacks who had discretionary funds that could be used for non-essentials. And they could, and then they wanted to also appear to be a part of the masses. And so they bought those kind of art. They bought so the most successful group in the country was the Afro Cobra. And Afro Cobra did a collective move. When they're in their shows, of course they had some outspoken advocates. And it was clearly something, the craftsmanship, the abilities of the artists was undeniable. The expertise in that, what they were doing, the way they did it was undeniable. And they explained what the difference was and how it related to. And so the and so another part of the masses love to hear them defy the system. And so they didn't make the kind of money that Sam was making. But what they did was they told the people that came to their shows, you pick any one of their works, you vote for one of their works that you would buy, you know, and you could get it for $10. And so what they did was they made serigraphs and silk screens of the ones that the people liked, and they helped each other to do that. And so I got a Wadsworth Gerald on my wall. I think I gave him $12 for it. It's Angela Davis thing. It's worth at least $5,000-$6,000 now. I mean, that's what he sold him for. The few he's got, he said, I tell him I only got five left. I got about 200 of them damn things left. So you can get the last of this one. So when they go to his place, and he they may be up to $12,000 now, because about 10, 12 years ago, he broke the record for a street sale. He sold all a painting off the street for $9,000.
Jeez.
That he couldn't get but $10 for it late, earlier. And then he, since then, he told me he got, his Malcolm, he got $85,000 for it. He was selling to 12, and the guy was eager, but he came back, he said, no, I want 25. And, then he ended up keeping it, and he got 85 for it. And I think he got $75,000, and the actual piece of the original piece of Angela went on Angela Davis. And Nelson Stevens has been selling his work well now too, because people want to collect them.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had some shows in some other circulating shows. And they still meet as a group. Not in the same way, I think. But I remember when I was in graduate school at Iowa, people wanted to know, when I chose to do my dissertation on Nelson Stevens and the Black Hearts Movement, they thought, you're wasting your time. Because even that was in 81. The art world was still debating about the validity of their art, the value of it, or the meaning of it. But I was convinced that because already my paintings, I've got works now that nobody would show because they're nudes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the use of color and design and the composition, it's, you know, same vein as what the Black Arts Movement is. You look at their work, because they all openly rejected their earlier teachings of tone your colors down, your work is too busy. But that is the same as African art. So that's my writings have been about that as well. But if I had not been a rebel myself, I wouldn't have recognized that, you know.
Did you see art, especially in like the Louisville Art Workshop and things like that? Did you see your all's art as an opportunity to advance Black folks in Louisville and in the community?
Oh yeah, because we had a good following. And because the whites came to our shows in the West End, and Sarah Lansdale wrote about them. Sarah Lansdale was enamored with us. And then the fact, too, that our political and social approach was one that was in tune with polite racism. I see that. But nobody, none of us were condescending. We were this. Those took people as they came, and our patrons as they came. Mrs. Norton bought our works, but sad to say, when she died and when the half of her people dealt with Wave, because they had not only our works but other artists, because they would buy works that from the art shows. But she particularly bought Black artwork. When she died, the works that she had that could have been identified as Black got thrown in the alley. So you could have got some early, those that didn't get picked up out of garbage bin and discarded. Someone said they saw one of my paintings. I had no idea I would have got it. But they had said they hadn't seen it. I don't know whether anybody picked it up, took it home. But her efforts was seen as overly patronizing. I'm sure that she was genuine in her purchase and in her attitude. But it just shows you about racism, you know, that people under her who could not do it when she was alive accepted her as being liberal, whatever. But those that didn't agree with her when they had a chance to show how they really felt about her, you know, it's just sad. So I'm just saying that for a time, the workshop ended clearly, because the reason Ed came to us was because he was wasn't respected. And I'm sure his teachers respected his abilities, but he felt that they didn't give him the time. Of course, now most whites can't afford his work. He gets $10,000 to $12,000 for copies, and so he beat the system. But While I continue to paint and sculpt and things, but my main efforts have been in teaching and research and writing.
Mm-hmm. When you all first enrolled at U of L, how were you all met? I mean, how was the
art? Polite. It's polite, like I said, but when I asked one professor about them, I said, you only here because we're nice to you. Basically, you haven't done anything to the world. Black people have not done anything in the consequence. Now, when I study the real history of the world, it's just the opposite. You know, whites have perfected, but they didn't create those original things. Mm-hmm. You know, most whites in the world still believe that the Egyptians was white, and you know, and you go there and see that stuff. It's amazing. I was in the Egyptian Museum, in Cairo, and I'm in Manhattan, the third. You know, it looked less like my uncle than anybody else. The guys, and the woman said, "Look, oh, it looks like uncle." The guy, the young man, he said, "Well, he wasn't really black. He wasn't really black." That ain't really a book. It just looked like a book. And that's what happened during the period of our enslavement period. Enslavement period. I was saying to a young man, teacher class at Simmons, that what we all rational justify, like we explain, what if we do, we have an explanation for it. And the more absurd it gets, you may have to have a rationalization. Or a justification, you know. I step on your foot. I say, "Oh, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't see it. I'm explaining it." You know, if I say, "Your foot shouldn't have been there no damn way. It's my bad." You're justifying that. You apologize. You're justifying it.
Mm-hmm.
You say, "Well, it had been lighter in this room," I think. I could have seen it. You're rationalizing it. So, during that period, that's explainable. It's not unforgivable, but it's explainable. So if we don't understand the full consequences of our action as a period, as an epic, as an episode that's periodical or historical, we can't begin to prevent it from happening, reoccurring.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't done that very well. You wouldn't have Donald Trump saying the ridiculous thing that he says. You can't believe. You didn't say that. You didn't. And you don't believe that.
Yeah.
You know, and he probably does. You know, it's laughable.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's dangerous. You know, because the Jews made a mistake and laughed at Hitler. They laughed at Hitler. Called him a buffoon, and, you know. And he remained that, but he was one that people accepted as an alternative, and then he became dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And he got piled so quickly that people around him who would have thrown him out in the street by the seat of his pants 10 years earlier were scared to touch him.
How did Ural's art kind of... how did it contribute to a broader cultural identity in Louisville? And did you all use your art to kind of display your own?
No, that group, art was never. Because I was beginning to question those things. So we were never. We were politically conscious, but we were never. I guess the group was where Martin Luther King was at. Integration won't be too bad, because if white people get to know us, they'll like us. That's true. That is true, but not for everybody, not for all whites, and so. So, as America has yet to deal with that, yet individual basis, you know, for the first time in the history of our country in the last 20, 30 years, you have white males legitimating their relationship with black women. Before, you just take her, use her, and throw her away. You don't marry her, you know. I was laughing at people, and Jennifer Lopez and. Affleck. I said, "No, he ain't not gonna marry that girl." You know, man, she been half dressed with Puffy. Somebody gonna remind him of that. You know, I said, now I don't know what his red reason was for falling apart, but I'm saying, looking at what I see and saw about and know about American history and experience. But you don't take my word for it, because I mean, my explanation may not be what it was at all, because until Obama won North Carolina. I said, man, he understands the change. You know, I said, it's a great movement, but. And my generation, we just never saw that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happened to the whites in my generation. They had no idea that Martin and what they said about Martin had impacted the young whites, the crossover votes, and the cell phone voters, because they didn't know what they was thinking, because they believed that in the they had been told.
Who's in power?
Not the color of the skin, but the.
You? You empowered the preachers and scholars?
The content of the character. Not the color of the skin. And they believed that. And when they heard him speak the content of his character, they believed it. And, you know. And of course, I look back at some people I might. But I think he tried to do all those things he believed he could do. Well, he didn't get rid of Guantanamo. But I said, yeah. Because he said, well, you had to have open and fair trials. And the best place to have is in the New York. And I said, oh, no. No, you can't break it up in here. No, let me be trying to get it. No, no, no. And so the people that believed in him didn't have power. They haven't gained. And the fear of losing it all, even those who what they call liberal are sideliners. That they don't, you know, they're sideliners. Hillary, you know, I think if Trump and some other people, it looks like they're bothered because their nomination. The more moderate Republicans not going to, they may not make it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Tea Party people and that far right group may have enough power in the convention to put him up, to accept a Cruz or what's the guy in Florida. He's they'll push him into the Trump behavior or explanation. Can't think of his name. Cruz out of Texas, right?
I think so, yeah.
And there was a boy in Florida. And he may get it. That's the best, you know. Now, let's see. But back to the, we were more like the civil rights movement in our social and political stance. What are these people like on the ground talking about? So. Yeah, you couldn't put that either one of those groups. Now, because in 58, 59, of the boldness to create a.
But you know, and it's interesting because you could put
Gallery Enterprise and where we were forced to put it would look more like what the black arts movement looked like. But did we had at the group as a group as a pub, as a politically conscious group, it wasn't there. But we were just trying to. We were celebrating the masses, mm-hmm. because of what we were forced to be. Because urban renewal hadn't taken place, and so circumstances made us look more like what the Black Arts Movement did on purpose. So in that sense, naively or unwittingly, we were
the
Gallery, yeah, the Gallery Enterprises was and at that time my works, because art patronage in the black community was more acceptable to figurative art, because I was a figurative artist, and those who were not as figurative as I was, but we weren't making no money.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, my art outsold Sam's, you know, even in the, even with the clothesline shows, my prints and things.
No, but it is interesting. I mean, right? Because
they were bar scenes, because I worked at the bartender. So I did painted what I saw, painted what I believed. Hey, Kenny, what's happening? What are we looking at? Okay. Okay. So it looks about $500 or something. $526 for four tires. Okay, I'll get back to you this evening. Okay. Okay, I believe you. All right.
But I think those are important.
Yeah, that was but the movement, in a sense, without them, we helped move. I think we had an impact on the art, the total global art scene, and that that's stuff. What I would argue that what we did. You know, it was played into the the art scene itself, and because Louisville is comparatively progressive about the arts, the total art scene. And when there were those who were doubting, say, ATL. When they had their theater at 10th, at the 10th Street railroad station, they took over that building down at 10th Street. And we, Lowell Art Workshop artist had an exhibit down there for the first one.
We shall see.
First one.
All right, sounds
and,
good.
And, you know, we had two white artists in the group. Robin Logsdon and Robin Logsdon and another young man. So in essence, I probably and nobody doubts the impact of it anymore, you know, that it has. And so the acceptance of other young black artists is reaping some benefit from that, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I would say yes. So it was significant for that reason. And many people were sympathetic to what we were trying to do, and supportive. But as a politically conscious part of the Black Arts Movement. But as I have written about it, and as it was looked at when it was first criticized because of the white analysis of the early stages of the Black Arts Movement, was that they were highly critical and said it wasn't art at all, it was all just propaganda. And that's all art is anyway. At one level, it is promoting an aspect of its culture from mm-hmm. which it springs. But so in that sense,
Can you kind of touch on the kind of the difference between this idea of revolutionary art from the Black Arts Movement as compared to more of black artists just creating art and the cultural advancement that sprung from that? Where did the two separate?
It separated in the Black Arts Movement was highly verbal about what they were doing and why they did it, and critical of other Black artists that didn't do that. And so, now, however, as both as they look back on it, some of the people that say were critical of Sam on Sam's success in D.C. and he wasn't a part of the Black Arts Movement, they no longer hold those views. And the way I explain Sam's work is composition, color-wise, he fits the theory, because he slowly gave up his muted sense of color. Beautifully done works, but he would have highly, because he was always very painterly. But his colors were not bold and high contrast. But as he became more and more successful, that is art. Those abstract expressionistic. Compositions is just is as much, it fits into my concept of a use of dominant cultural elements, a use of called high contrast, complex compositions, bold, brilliant colors. And it just, and as older he gets, the more they're there. And when he moved into the draped dyed thing, he was dunking the ball, bouncing the ball behind his back. And the first players that did that were called Traveling, and they outlawed dunking for a while. So he was being Black, he was being African, he was dealing with those inner expressions, that so in that sense,
when did you all kind of start to see these racial walls coming down surrounding your all's art? Not just with the integration of your all's group, you know, having some white members in the group, but as, you know, the community as a whole, when did you start to see the art that you black folks were making, like, widely accepted?
You know, they're what I would call widely accepted. More than one of us would be in the AIDS in AIDS position. I guess you talk with Walter. That's 10th Street. As the gallery, the Black Arts Gallery, the Black Gallery. It's a Black gallery owner. It deals with all black artists. And all over the country, he sells art all over the country. He could probably tell you what percentage of his patrons, customers are a percentage of white down there. I don't know. It has some impact. It's definitely moved the bar, so. And I haven't talked to one or two really young black artists, and I don't know how much he's selling. None of us have ever heard of this. I can just say it had an impact. It was helpful. And this happened after the the 90s. And with the in the 90s. GC died, probably one of the most talented, but he died thinking pretty much like Van Gogh, you know. Although he sold works and got some acceptance. He had a show in D.C. thanks to Sam. But that, you know, he didn't die as in bad a shape as Van Gogh. But almost, you know, Van Gogh, I think his work, all his efforts were worthless. And that's so cruel, you know. You can't get a piece of art under $50 to $60 million. He couldn't get a nickel for it. His brother bought his works. So the art scene is a fickle scene. It's anyway. The larger group. We all part of it, it's the membership. The art, the people that I don't know, that can tell you. Because you have that First Friday and other things, so. It's, the art scene is as good here as anywhere else in this kind of population.
Mm-hmm. Can you think, and this is something I ask everybody, like, is there other people who you think would be worth me interviewing? Folks from the time or people that were involved?
But most people, the young artists were never involved in the collective scene. They have just benefited from it.
Mm-hmm.
But Lucille Allen, you talked to Lucille Allen?
I left her a message.
Okay. Because she's been in the thing a long time. And she benefited from as much of white patrons as any other patron. Mm-hmm. But she was not a part of a gallery enterprise or the art workshop. She was a chemist and she became more involved after she retired in art.
Can you think of any of the younger folks who benefited from it?
She's my age. Did Ed know any? Did he give you any of the young ones other than Duffy?
Duffy?
William Duffy. I used to have a number for him, but Ed's got a number for him. But Duffy's a sculptor. He does graphic work, has done graphic works as well. But, and, has made some money with his art, and he sells pieces, but not, I don't know what the how well he's doing, but he used to come to the workshop as a kid. And there's the only ones I know that he would be what I call fourth generation.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth generation artist, Kentucky local artist.
Do you have like any contact information or anything for Sam Gilliam? I know, does he still live in D.C.?
He's still there. I lost my other phone and I had Sam's number in it, but I don't think I got him here. I'd see his maiden sister. I don't have anything for Gilliam anymore. And I had both his numbers because the last time we were in Louisville together, we all partied together.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ed may have a number for him. Yeah, I lost my phone about a month ago.
Yeah, I've been there.
And it wasn't on the cloud as I thought it was. So I couldn't download nothing, had nothing to download. Yeah.